it's been a fairly legal couple of weeks, wouldn't you say, Dave?
Absolutely. There's a lot going on in the legal realms, aren't there? Isn't there?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, last week we were talking about probably the weirdest lawsuit I've seen in some time.
That was a really fun one.
Yeah. This week we're talking about all sorts of legal stuff. You're listening to Ask an Atheist with me, Sam Mulvey, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842, toll-free nationwide. That is our voicemail number. With me today is Dave. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. I had 5-year-olds screaming at me yesterday.
And that makes you excellent?
Yes, yes.
He's recovering well.
Niece's birthday party. The range at which 5-year-old girls can scream, it's like this banshee-like, real high pitch. It's almost...
That's how they get those ringtones, right? And Rajan, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
Awesome.
Fantastically.
Fantastically. Yes. Oh. Oh, crap. Do we have to be grammatically correct on this show now?
No.
I am totally in trouble. So, like I said, legal stuff. Let's get right to it. The Supreme Court has refused to hear a challenge to New Jersey's gay conversion therapy ban. The law signed by Governor Chris Christie in August of 2013 was being challenged by a group of therapists and a group of Christian counselors. By refusing to hear the case, the court upholds the Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruling upholding the ban. The Supreme Court previously refused to hear a challenge to a similar law in California.
Yay, Supreme Court.
Hey, exactly. I get it right occasionally.
Mm-hmm. Just in this particular case, they're also saying that this doesn't actually rise to the level of needing an additional review. They're just like,
right.
Yeah, they got it right.
Yeah.
We're done.
Solid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, we're busy people. We've got more things to do with our time than, you know, try and figure out whether or not you did a right thing right.
This is like they shock you in a very sensitive place when you look at porn. This is that kind of therapy, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, does that deserve... That kind of stuff just, really bothers
you
me.
You just derailed my brain on this statement.
But they're calling it therapy because they're attempting to wrap themselves in the cloth of medicine and of psychology, which is... You know, which is the kind of joke psychology doesn't need right now, let's be honest.
Right.
And...
Or medical science generally.
Or medical science.
I think we've had enough of that with Food Babe and Australian Food Babe.
Oh, you know what we're going to see next? Quantum gay conversion therapy. Just you wait,
kids. Wasn't here for our quantum fest.
I didn't know Deepak Chopra was getting into that business.
No. It would surprise me not a whit.
Well, and I think...
It's not that Deepak Chopra is into it. It's that it is in deep.
Less said about that.
Right.
I think when it comes down to the gay conversion thing is it's this certain brand of religious people's way of sort of sticking their fingers in their ears, screaming, la, 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 I can't hear your arguments that say I might be wrong. And because the last thing they want to admit is that being gay isn't a choice, and they've been terrible people for this long.
Yeah,
they just have to keep doubling down and doubling down and doubling down. Otherwise, they have to admit they're horrible.
I really think they're walking on really thin ice with this one. I know we live in America, Christian social substrate. They'll never have to deal with the fact that they have this privilege. But if you can get therapy where it's okay for you to have real horrible things happen to you in order to make you stop being a thing that is a choice, I wouldn't start with homosexuality. I'd start with, I don't know, being a fundamentalist Christian. Is there a fundamental? Yes, there is. Never mind. Wow, that's creepy. They in fact, call that. What did they call that? Deprogramming, I believe, is what that was.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, which is essentially, which, by the way, is a fairly discredited field at this point, I think. Yeah. I was listening to an interview with Heber Jensch, who hasn't been seen since 2006 while we're telling tales out of school. In the 80s with the Cult Awareness Network and in the middle of the deprogramming thing. Man, the 80s were creepy for religion, weren't they?
Yeah.
Well, the 80s were what happened when, like, you didn't really know what anyone needed to do or wanted to do, and everyone had extra money. Right? So the 80s were basically college for older people.
College for older people. Well, okay.
We can look at like all the stuff that have the satanic panic, which is hilarious till you remember that someone is still in jail over that.
It wasn't hilarious when I was living through it. I remember that much. Yeah. Because, you know, family into the rock music and suddenly we're all Satanists. Which,
well, or running a D&D group.
Or running a D&D
group.
Yeah,
it's like, you're playing cards and using dice.
I have no way to connect that, so I'm not going to bother.
I saw your paladin sleeping with the devil.
It's your fault Blackleaf died. I'd like to thank Sean from Tacoma, Peggy from Kent, Washington, and Rich from actual Kent for meeting Peggy's challenge. Peggy's challenge is the challenge to the listeners of Ask an Atheist to help us keep the lights on. If you'd like to contribute to Peggy's challenge, you can go to askanatheist.tv, click on the yellow button on the right-hand side, and it'll take you straight to our PayPal page. Every dollar you give to Ask an Atheist goes directly toward show production, not like a round of drinks or a golden toilet or a new jet.
Getting my new jet? You
no.
promised.
I thought that the round of drinks and the golden toilet were actually related to each other.
Of course they are.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure. We're all about causality here.
Yeah.
So.
But I'm envisioning the future, you know, 50, 60 years down the line. They're going to be talking about gay conversion therapy the way we talk about parlor lobotomies now.
Or the physiognomy where it's
or
like,
physiognomy,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the shape of the head and trepanation and all that stuff.
Well, and I think actually even more like phrenology, because the basis of phrenology was racism.
And, right. Oh, yeah.
You know, when the foundation of something is hate, it's not going to eventually.
Why did I sound happy about that? That was horrible.
Oh, yeah. Racism.
Yeah. Hooray. Yeah. What is my deal?
We'll cut your bigotry out in post.
No, I'm going to make myself live with that. Hey, if I kept that stuff about the Czech Republic in last week, I got to keep it. I got to keep this in now. I mean.
So we talked a little bit about this. I've been to the Czech Republic several times. I when I was listening to that aspect of that segment of the show, it was hysterical.
Okay.
I loved it. and I do not think anyone in the Czech Republic should feel bad about that. If anything, it all comes from love.
I've gotten email, I've gotten comments from people who thought it was funny. I got comments from people who thought I was a little hard on Becky, which is actually most of the fan mail I get now is I'm terrible at Becky. But no comments about how we're horrible about the Czech Republic. I'm actually a little surprised.
Okay.
No hate mail there.
Do you want me to push the envelope?
What do
for you?
I have to do?
Yes.
Our ongoing mission to get a single hate mail letter from
right.
the Czech Republic.
No, yes.
Only you can complete our mission.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yes.
I'm not trying.
If you have ideas about how we can get hate mail, go to the website and see and look for the button marked Becky's Challenge.
Becky's Challenge. No, I'm not looking for hate mail. We get enough of that. Believe you me. I'm looking specifically for hate mail from the Czech Republic. Why? I have no idea. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're going to go to a break, and when we return, we'll be talking to David Niosi about all this legal stuff happening right now. It's a great interview. A lot of meat to it.
Billy! Billy! Billy, I am the Queen of England. You must give me your lunch money.
Why?
Because it'll explode.
I don't know.
I'm the Queen of England. I know things.
Well, that makes sense. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because an authority says it doesn't make it true. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I'm melting!
Looking to buy or sell a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, or surrounding areas? Demand a professional and call Don Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 or visit dndrealty.ca and discover how he works with you to achieve your goals, save you time, and protect your investment. Don Summers of Professional Realty Group. It's time you hired a professional.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran, and we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is the United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them them know that Radio vs. the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVsTheMartians.com.
Imagine tropical waters, warm sandy beaches, friendly people, incredible weather. The English-speaking Caribbean island nation of St. Lucia awaits. Don Summers and his team at Professional Realty Group are ready to assist you. Whether you're looking for an investment, a place to retire, or a killer vacation property, St. Lucia has homes in all price ranges starting at $110,000. Call Don at 780-237-4718 and check out dndrealty.ca.
Join Seattle Atheists at the Hall at Fauntleroy on June 4th for an evening with Seth Andrews, host and producer of the award-winning Thinking Atheist podcast. A former Christian and religious broadcaster, Seth's everyman approach brings millions into the conversation about religious beliefs. Doors for this event open at 6 p.m. for a cash bar reception, followed by a talk at 7:15. Seth will stick around afterwards for a signing of his new book, Sacred Cows. Tickets can be purchased at the door and at brownpapertickets.com. Brought to you by Seattle Atheists. We believe in you.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. Joining us now is David Neosi. He's an author and lawyer who has served as president of both the Secular Coalition for America and the American Humanist Association. He's the author of Nonbeliever Nation, The Rise of Secular Americans, and Fighting Back the Right, Reclaiming America, from the Attack on Reason. He currently serves as the legal advisor for the AHA and writes for Psychology Today. How are you doing, David?
Hey, very good. Thanks for having me.
No problem. The Supreme Court recently heard arguments about the questions on same-sex marriage and is expected to rule on the matter next month. I always have difficulty figuring out what is going on with the Supreme Court. You have a little bit more experience than I do. Well, you have millions of times more experience than I do. How did you think the oral arguments went?
Well, you know, just because you have a hard time figuring out what's going on with the Supreme Court doesn't mean that we lawyers have any easier of a time figuring out what's going on with the Supreme Court. So my guess is that it's going to be a 5-4 decision, although, you know, that could be dead wrong as well. But to tell you the truth, I thought oral arguments went in a direction that made me a little bit uncomfortable being an advocate for same-sex marriage. I didn't like some of the questions that Justice Kennedy was asking. They seemed to indicate that he was sympathetic to the idea that marriage has been defined as one man, one woman for millennia. The whole millennia argument came up, and the states' rights issue that, you know, marriage is something that's usually been left to the states. So although Kennedy has been the key vote in other same-sex marriage cases, the Windsor case from a few years ago and even going back further, on this particular issue, I'm not so sure I feel comfortable that he's going to go the right way, but I certainly hope he does.
So this is a conversation we were having right before we went into the interview, which was, you know, the Supreme Court is an organization. It's like the sole remaining federal organization, I feel like, where you can't call a member of it a moron without getting in trouble. What happens when they bring up something like the millennia stuff, where they bring up something that's factually incorrect? How is there any way you can correct that in the sort of the back and forth of what happens in the courtroom?
Well, realistically, once arguments have happened, you know, the presentment of facts and legal arguments is over. It's in their hands. They debate it within chambers and come out with their decision a couple months later. So realistically, correcting any misnomers is just not going to happen.
Is it a question of protocol within the oral arguments itself, or is there any way to perhaps respond after oral arguments? I guess the answer might actually just simply be no, just because amicus briefs have to be filed prior to the actual oral.
Right. After oral argument, there really is no more presentment of any kind of legal briefs or arguments. At a lower level, if you're arguing at a trial court level on summary judgment or even at an appellate court level, if a decision comes down after oral argument that might sway the court, especially if it's controlling precedent on the issue that the court is considering at the time, time, you are allowed to send in a supplemental notice to the court saying, hey, over in the third district, in the third circuit, they just decided a case just like this, and here's how they analyzed it, you know, and if it's something that's relevant, you can submit it. But when you're at the Supreme Court level, there is no other court issuing precedent that's controlling right. the Supreme Court. You're at the top of the heap right there. So unless you can say God dictated XYZ, which, as we all know on this show, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's a bit unlikely.
I mean,
I think that's the other side's argument, usually.
Right, exactly. We
right,
have controlling
exactly,
interest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've got God on their side. Unfortunately, he never shows up for oral arguments.
He is actually either absent or perennially late to all right. court proceedings involving her.
So,
that's right.
Speaking of briefs, the Epignani Humanist Legal Center filed an amicus brief in favor of the plaintiffs. What are the key points from a humanist perspective in that brief?
Well, what we really argue is that same-sex orientation should be considered a suspect class for equal protection purposes, and that there are religious reasons why there is prejudice against same-sex orientation, and those religious arguments, you know, we come from a humanist secular angle, so we can kind of offer that viewpoint to the court, and we just point out that there are religious arguments that work in favor of the anti-gay rights position, and that those religious arguments should not be given weight by the court. So that's how we come at it. And I think most seculars are sympathetic to the idea of same-sex marriage. There certainly are some atheists out there who might think that, you know, marriage just shouldn't be redefined this way, or in that's their prerogative. But I think the great weight of the atheist, humanist, agnostic, secular, free thought community is sympathetic to same-sex marriage.
I would hardly call it a scientific survey, but in the early days of this show, we were like, well, we'd like to come out and say that marriage equality is a thing that is just, it just makes sense from a secular perspective. And we actually asked, you know, we had people looking around, we openly solicited for, hey, is there a non-religious reason to be against marriage equality? We looked for about 6 months and actively looked. We took phone calls from people. Mm-hmm. The best we heard was basically the ick factor. That was all we heard. And most of the time it was, I'm not against it, but if I were to think of an argument, this is what it would be.
Right.
It was,
nobody had, I guess, in the outside of a court, there's still a concept of standing, if you will, that, like, it's not my argument, but people might say.
Right.
Right. But it was, there was never anyone who actually was able to step forward and say, I personally have a non-religious argument against same-sex marriage. Here it is.
Yeah, I've met a few people over the years, but very few who feel that civil unions should be enough. You know, that's reasonable minds can differ. I think that argument has kind of withered over the years. I think maybe 15 years ago, you would have met more people who would have thought civil unions are adequate. But when you really sit down and analyze the issue, you realize that there's no reason to hold the definition of the term marriage up to some, you know, higher standard, and, you know, that gays and lesbians get civil unions and, you know, heterosexual couples get marriage. That's just not fair. I think there was a time when a lot of people, more people than now, thought it was fair. But, you know, we should understand that seculars do disagree on some issues. I was at an AHA conference last week, and there was a table. It was not a very active table, but some group that was anti-choice, atheists against abortion rights or something like that. I don't know what it was called, but there are actually atheists out there who feel that, you know, life begins at conception or whatever. And, in fact, there are some high-profile atheists who feel that way. There's Nat Hentoff, I think, who used to write for The Village Voice, was a well-known atheist who was against abortion rights. So, we have to recognize that atheism is not a monolith in terms of political views, that there is some diversity and some different ways of looking at different political issues.
Not at all. And in fact, I will say we tried to do the same thing, or we did do the same thing with, reproductive rights. And when we started talking about that, we definitely got there was a lot more division on that one.
Right.
Not that there was significant division.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, there was...
More so than same-sex marriage, huh?
Very much so. Yeah. I would say the clear majority was in favor of reproductive rights, but... there was definitely, you know, when we said, hey, are there secular reasons to be against abortion? We heard from several people who said they themselves were against it within a week, where, like, we kept the door open for 6 months on marriage equality, and we heard nothing.
And I think there was also more compelling reasons. Like, there was the secular reasons against against marriage equality. There was nothing. There was absolutely nothing there.
Yeah. So,
except that's the way it's always been done.
Twas always thus. Yeah. That's which is a weak argument to begin with. We've been talking a lot about the role of the Abignani Legal Center and particularly around gay marriage in the case that's before the court now. What is the interaction between the Abignani Legal Center and the AHA's LGBTQ Council?
I'm sorry, you cut out there. What's the interaction between our legal center and who?
And the AHA's LGBTQ Council?
They are just different branches, if you will, or departments of the AHA. The American Humanist Association, if you go to our website, AmericanHumanist.org, you'll see, if you scroll down to the bottom, there's a little box for every arm of the AHA, the Legal Center, the Education Center, the Feminist Caucus, and the LGBT Caucus. These groups just interact to the extent it's necessary. Our legal center spends the great weight of its time on establishment clause and church state issues that don't directly touch upon LGBT issues. So there's not a whole lot of interaction on a daily basis between the LGBT caucus and the legal center, because we are usually involved in issues that don't have much to do with LGBT rights. But certainly, if something comes along, we'd be interacting with them.
Mm-hmm. And so, when getting back to the oral arguments, the court was really splitting the... there's two questions in front of the court, and the first question is... it's focused on whether same-sex marriage is protected under the 14th Amendment. What are the arguments for and against that, and what are they looking like?
Well, equal protection at the federal level is rather interesting, because there are not enumerated classes in the 14th Amendment, although the 14th Amendment was originally passed mainly for the issue of racial injustice. It was passed right after the Civil War, and the idea was to make sure that freed slaves got equal protection under the law. The 14th Amendment doesn't list enumerated classes such as race, sex, ethnicity, and other areas that we would usually consider suspect classifications for equal protection purposes. So because same-sex orientation has never been considered a suspect class under the 14th Amendment, and it's certainly not enumerated, even race is not expressly enumerated in the 14th Amendment, the argument is it's never been recognized as such, so why should it be now? The argument in favor of giving suspect classification to same-sex orientation is that it's a quality that has historically been very much discriminated against in society and under the law. It's a status that is very much ostracized in public and has been subjected to much hostility and all that, and therefore it's in need of heightened scrutiny. And this gets a little technical, but under the law, if a classification such as race or sex or ethnicity or religious minorities, for example, or if these classifications get heightened scrutiny, it means if a law discriminates against that class, it gets struck down much easier. Because after all, if you think about it, laws discriminate against groups all the time. Speeding laws just discriminate against people who want to go fast, right? You know, every law out there discriminates against someone. But when we're talking about equal protection, suspect classification, such as race and sex and others, those laws that discriminate against those areas get struck down easier. They get heightened scrutiny by the court. So our argument on the same-sex marriage side is that same-sex orientation has never been given heightened scrutiny, but it should be now. It should be because gays and lesbians have historically been so discriminated against as the type of class of society that deserves special protection. And that's the argument. So there's another layer to the argument as well, in that even if you don't give a group like same-sex orientation special scrutiny, it's laws that discriminate against them still have to at least pass a rational scrutiny. They have to have some rational basis. And many of the cases on same-sex marriage have won for the same-sex orientation side on a rational scrutiny basis. The courts have said, we're not going to give you heightened scrutiny, but you know what? This law can't even pass rational scrutiny, so we're going to strike it down. And that's how it all got started with the Goodridge case in Massachusetts. The Massachusetts court did not give same-sex couples heightened scrutiny, but they said even without heightened scrutiny, discriminating against this group and not giving them marriage rights, there's no rational reason for doing it at all. So we're not going to let the discrimination continue.
Mm-hmm. So I know there are two questions being answered here, and I've heard this often. There are two questions being answered here, and then there's a long discussion on the 14th Amendment, which I think seems to be the really important one. What is the other question being asked in this case?
There are two questions being
apparently.
The two big issues really are whether heightened scrutiny is going to be given to same-sex orientation.
Got it.
That's a question that the court has to answer. And the other alternative question is, if you don't give them heightened scrutiny, does discriminating against them still fall short of even rational scrutiny? So that's kind of the two-tier analysis. If the court decides to give same-sex orientation heightened scrutiny, almost certainly same-sex marriage will win. Because with heightened scrutiny, it's very hard to allow a law that discriminates against a class that gets heightened scrutiny. But even if they don't give same-sex couples heightened scrutiny, it's very conceivable that same-sex marriage could still win on the argument that not allowing it is not rational in any way, that there's no rational basis for not allowing same-sex marriage. So that's the two-tier. And if you were to present to me that there are two questions to be asked, I think that's how I would look at the two questions.
All right. Well, if we can move to the actual personalities in the court for a moment, where everybody's expecting this to fall upon ideological lines with Kennedy as the swing vote. Why is Kennedy the swing vote here?
Well, it's just his history. He has gone. He's been very unpredictable on a lot of cases. He's not a Scalia or an Alito who is predictably always going to come down on a certain side on cultural cases or, cases that involve culture war issues, so to speak. This goes back all the way to the early 90s, the Lee versus Weissman case. It was a graduation prayer case where the court was expected to allow graduation prayers. And originally, when the vote was originally taken among the justices, there was a 5-4 majority for allowing graduation prayers. And then at the last minute, when Kennedy was reading the opinions, he was actually swayed by the arguments on the other side, and he jumped. And Lee versus Weissman ended up being a great case for our side because it strikes down graduation prayers, even non-Christian, non-sectarian graduation prayers. They're just not allowed in a public school setting. And Scalia went berserk when this happened. He was mad at Kennedy, and I don't know if he's talking to him yet, but it's and Kennedy has just been the swing vote that way on a number of cases going right through Lawrence v. Texas, and other cases. cases. It's just the character that he's kind of constructed for himself on the court. And historically, he'll be remembered as a very significant justice, in hindsight, because he's been the deciding vote, probably arguably the most powerful man in Washington.
They're not allowed to pray at graduation ceremonies, somebody ought to tell Texas. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're talking to David Niozzi, lawyer and author of Fighting Back the Right, Reclaiming America from the Attack on Reason. Go to a break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking.
After a deadly tornado destroyed her family's home, Rebecca Witzman teamed up with Foundation Beyond Belief to use her background in volunteer coordination to develop humanist disaster recovery teams. Seattle Atheists and Foundation Beyond Belief will welcome Rebecca at 7 p.m. on May 26th at Town Hall Seattle. Buy tickets for Rebecca Witzman After the Disaster at brownpapertickets.com or at the door. For more information, visit seattleatheists.org.
Imagine tropical waters, warm sandy beaches, friendly people, incredible weather. The English-speaking Caribbean island nation of St. Lucia awaits. Don Summers and his team at Professional Realty Group are ready to assist you. Whether you're looking for an investment, a place to retire, or a killer vacation property, St. Lucia has homes in all price ranges starting at $110,000. Call Don at 780-237-4718 and check out dndrealty.ca.
48 hours, 24 hours, 10 minutes to go.
The motorcade appears to have stopped, and yes, it appears as though the governor is getting out now. It's hard to see. My God, the rain is coming down in sheets. I've never seen anything like this. There must be tens of thousands of people out here right now. The streets are shut down. Okay, it appears the governor is making his way toward the convention center. No one knows what he's going to say. The crowd is pushing forward through the storm. The Secret Service is struggling to hold them back. A wave of people are rushing toward the candidate. My God.
Zero. For your consideration, we present Convention and its subject, the nominee. ANNEX Radio.com. Now on iTunes and Stitcher.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC. We're talking with David Niozzi, author and lawyer, about what's going on in the Supreme Court. And you had one question to wrap it up before we move on to other subjects, didn't you, Dave?
Yeah. There was a... During arguments, Justice Alito, strangely enough, brought up the full faith and credit clause of the Article 4, and basically questioning about whether or not if a state allows gay marriage if another state must recognize that. And how did those arguments work out? And
well, the usual way of approaching marriage among the states has always been that if a couple gets married in a state and then they move to another state, that marriage will be recognized in the new state, even if the marriage would not have been legal had it been performed there. For example, if Massachusetts has a law that says you have to be 18 to get married, but Mississippi has a law that says you can be 14 and get married, if a 16-year-old couple gets married in Mississippi and moves to Massachusetts at the age of 17, that marriage would be recognized by Massachusetts, even though that couple couldn't get married there. So that's the general idea of the full faith credit clause. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, will that work in the same-sex marriage context, or can the states affirmatively say we're not going to recognize same-sex marriages from other states? And that's a question that my understanding is the court should be answering in this case when the decision comes down, and we'll find out.
Right.
We were talking about this before the show, that there's a hypothetical that one could put together that so the example that you gave is an example of two people who get married in one state and then move to another state where they would be ineligible to be married at all because of their age. In this case, we're actually put in a situation where, in the gay marriage situation, or in a marriage equality concept and context, we're in a situation where each of the people in a marriage equality in a gay marriage is actually eligible for marriage in a state that bans gay marriage. They're just not eligible to marry each other. But what that means is they're eligible to be married to someone else. They're just not eligible to be married to each other in that new state. So if they're living in Iowa and they get married to each other, two men, for example, and they move to Tennessee, they're not eligible to be married to each other, but that marriage also isn't recognized. So technically, while there are arguments that are made that if you have gay marriage, then what's next? Polygamy, for example, they've actually created a context where it is possible to get married again. Those two people are not married in Tennessee, which means they could get married again. So don't the arguments that allow states to define marriage around gay marriage basically allow people to get married again?
Well, I think it could go that way, depending on how the laws get interpreted through the whole. I think you're opening up a real can of worms with that. But the idea...
I was aware of that, yes. Yeah,
in case you didn't notice. Yeah, but the idea that people can get married just not to each other is an issue that the court has dealt with before in the interracial marriage context, mm-hmm. Loving versus Virginia from 1967, the argument in favor of laws banning interracial marriage was that, well, these people can get married, they just can't get married to each other. These laws don't discriminate against blacks because whites can't marry blacks either. You know, it discriminates against white people and it discriminates against black people. So it doesn't really discriminate against anyone. That's the argument. But, you know, the court talked about that type of argument in Goodridge, the original same-sex marriage decision from Massachusetts, and they just don't buy it because the idea of modern marriage is, and this is where the definition is very much modern, the idea of marrying for love, you know, that's something that is not part of the historical notion of marriage that's been around for millennia. It's really a relatively new notion, but the idea of modern marriage is that one should be able to marry whom one wants. And that's, if the court looks at it in that way, it's not a can of worms at all. You just have a right to marry, whoever you want, whether it's a man or a woman.
Right. So there's a lot of, I don't know if it's more than usual, but there's a lot of legal cases going on in the atheism and humanism community right now. Specifically, we talked to Stephanie C. Gutterson last week, who is being sued by a faith healer out in Bisbee, Arizona. Do you have any thoughts on that particular case? Because, it seems like a kind of a shut and dried one with, one, fair use, and two, criticism, but it made it to the courts.
Well, it is an interesting case, and I think the most interesting thing about it is that it's not a defamation case. In other words, she really laid into him and called him all sorts of horrible things, and he didn't sue her for defamation because, my speculation is that truth is a defense in defamation cases. So, instead, he sued her for copyright infringement, and you're right. I'm not an intellectual property lawyer, so I don't want to go out on the limb too much, but in intellectual property, a copyright case, fair use and the idea of criticism and commentary are valid uses of copyrighted material. So I think from the little knowledge I have, she's got a pretty defensible case. But, it's no fun being sued even if you have a defensible case. And I think that's one thing the plaintiff probably realizes here, right, is that, no matter what happens, he's, got an uppercut to the jaw with a lawsuit like this. He's gone on the offensive and she's on the defensive. So I certainly hope she's got counsel. My understanding is that she does have counsel, and hopefully the case can get processed quickly and make its way through the courts, and maybe she'll get out on summary judgment without spending years in the court.
Right.
Have you heard cases similar to this one? Or is the not going after defamation and hitting copyright, is this a unique approach to this kind of case?
Well, I don't really know how unique it is. Certainly, copyright cases are out there. They're not a rarity.
Yeah.
Defamation cases can be rather difficult to win because you have to prove some kind of damages usually, and you know they're not easy cases. So how rare something like this is, I really don't know. I don't see too many of them, but I don't follow this area of law very closely either. I'm not an intellectual property lawyer who would be getting daily updates on, the latest copyright cases. I've got Establishment Clause cases coming into my inbox every day, but I don't follow intellectual property the same way.
Well, speaking of Establishment Clause cases, a county commissioner in Lincoln County, North Carolina, recently announced his refusal to allow any non-Christian prayers during commission meetings. Is a lawsuit really the only direct way to go from here? Is that the only way up?
Well, it might be if he's really stubborn about it, and of course, then you need the right plaintiff. You would think that if the court came down with a very clear decision saying that that's not the law, that he would follow the law. But I've been around long enough to realize that these local government officials sometimes could care less what the law is. So,
right.
Litigation might be necessary. We've got a legislative prayer case pending right now at the AHA. Against the Carroll County Commissioners in Carroll County, Maryland, and it's going to be one of the first legislative prayer cases to come down after the Supreme Court's decision from last year in Town of Greece versus Galloway. You're probably familiar with that case.
Oh, yes.
Boy, howdy.
Big decision the Supreme Court came down with last year, and it actually allowed sectarian legislative prayer. And I think the religious right has read that decision much too broadly to mean that anything goes. And, you know, maybe that's what this commissioner or this elected official down in North Carolina is thinking. Well, the Supreme Court gave the green light to sectarian prayer, so here in our county, we're just going to have Christian prayer, period.
Right.
That's not a correct interpretation of Town of Greece. In fact, there's a lot in the Town of Greece decision that really is pretty favorable to a secular view of legislative prayer. I mean, it's not a good decision. Don't get me wrong. It allows sectarian prayer. But it does, in many ways, stress limitations in a lot of ways that people have assumed haven't been the case. For example, the court expressly said that the legislators themselves should not be leading the prayers. Now, I think before the Town of Greece decision, the general feeling was that as long as the prayers were non-sectarian, it was all right for the legislators to lead the prayers. You know, a local town council at the beginning of the meeting, the town manager can say, all rise and lead some non-sectarian prayer. Instead, what the court said is the exact opposite. They said the town manager can't lead the prayer, nor can anyone on the board. But if they want to invite someone in, that someone can say not just a prayer, but even a sectarian prayer. So, but then they also said the prayer should not be too proselytizing, and it shouldn't be, I don't know the exact language they used, but it shouldn't be condemning people and things like that. It shouldn't be divisive, in other words, which is kind of funny to say a sectarian prayer shouldn't be divisive.
Yes, you can pray, it'll be nice.
Nature. But the decision is a very nuanced decision. It really does set down limitations that a lot of people didn't realize were there. So even though it allows the sectarian prayer, there are some things to really cling on to about it. And that's what we're running with in the Carroll County case, is we've got commissioners who are all about Jesus and really want to promote their Christianity, and they want to lead the prayers themselves. And we're pointing out that that's exactly what Town of Greece says you can't do.
I know exactly what you're talking about. But I mean, so it's a nuanced decision. It's a decision that does leave a lot of things open for a humanist. But let's Monday morning quarterback here. Was it actually the right call?
Oh, I don't think so, because I don't think, well, as a secularist, I don't think there should be any prayers at all at the beginning of meetings, and I'm sure that's not a controversial statement on this.
How dare you?
Yeah, not at all.
I believe we are what's called the choir in this situation.
Yeah, Exactly. But, you know, if you are going to have prayer, I would expect that it at least be non-sectarian prayer. But that's, the court said, no, it's perfectly fine. If you're going to invite a preacher in, don't make him say some generic prayer. If he's a, you know, Christian preacher, he can pray to Jesus. To me, that's just the wrong decision. It got it wrong. But the right things about it are that, you know, the legislators themselves shouldn't be praying. If it is going to be sectarian, it shouldn't be, you know, all fire and brimstone, and you know, so there are some things to, you know, you look for the silver lining in the cloud, and it is there in Dawn of Greece.
So we've also got Michael Newdow of California renewing his efforts to get In God We Trust taken off the currency, and that sort of dovetails with something we've been working on here in Pierce County and elsewhere to get In God We Trust taken off the walls of the county chambers. Why do you think In God We Trust and that logo has had such little success in the court so far?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, but I think part of the problem is that when it was originally brought in to the picture in the 1950s, there wasn't a whole lot of opposition to it. The 1950s were a disastrous decade for the secular community.
Okay.
There was a lot done. We have the National Day of Prayer. We have the National Prayer Breakfast. We have In God We Trust. We have Under God being put into the pledge. All of this happened within the span of just a few years during the 50s, and Eisenhower was getting baptized in the White House. It was just a mess of a decade for us. But I think because decades went by before there were any serious opposition to this, what happens with these phenomena is that they get embedded into the culture very quickly. And once they do, it's very hard to get them out. It really points to the need for vigilance when you do see the religious right doing anything to push the envelope these days. You don't let them, if you give an inch, that inch is gone, because you're not going to get it back. It's hard to push back once they've really entrenched themselves. So I think In God We Trust just became accepted very quickly by American culture, and by the time anyone really spoke up about it to challenge it at a high profile level, it was just accepted as, you know, harmless. When they talk about ceremonial deism, they talk about harmless references to God and religion and the culture. The problem that they don't see is that it's not harmless, that it really does. It promotes one view of American culture to the detriment of the minorities who don't share that view. And it's not even an accurate view. I think, you know, Jefferson and the Founding Fathers would roll over in their graves if they saw that the national motto of the country they created was In God We Trust. they had their own motto, E Pluribus Unum, which you know, seemed to work very well. It's a beautiful statement, out of many, one. You know,
yeah.
It points to the federal nature of our system and lots of other
it's
good
just so
things,
much more,
you know,
inclusive.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, from a melting pot standpoint, I don't think this is the way they intended it, but from a melting pot standpoint, you know, a nation of immigrants out of many, one, you know, it really, it's a motto that works.
It
works probably better than the Founding Fathers would have thought it would work. It really does. But when Obama referred to E Pluribus Unum as a motto that this country had in a speech once, the Congressional Prayer Caucus sent him a 2-page letter just laying into him for referring to E Pluribus Unum as the nation's motto.
Yeah.
And they were all over him in pointing out that In God We Trust is our national motto. So there is eternal vigilance on the other side, and unfortunately, because they don't let him get away with anything without getting all over him.
So it's not every day I'm talking to a lawyer who knows his stuff on this subject. So I'm going to ask a tactical question here. You know, Michael Newell has been renewing the legal efforts to get In God We Trust taken off the money. Here at the show, we've gone to Pierce County and then Clark County down in Washington, and we're gearing up to do some more stuff this summer about In God We Trust being put up in county chambers all over the country. Is there an angle on this that might be more successful than the angles we're attempting here in 2015?
Well, I think the Establishment Clause is probably still the best argument out there. And to attack it when it's being used in buildings that are going to be seen on a regular basis, especially by children, I think you've got something to cling on to there. I think there's an argument. I know Mike is using, and by the way, I know Mike fairly well. I've chatted with him many times over the years about Establishment Clause issues, and he's a very bright guy and an excellent lawyer. I can't imagine that lawyering is his second profession, because he's a doctor first and a lawyer second, but he's an excellent lawyer. I can imagine what a doctor he must be. But the argument he's going to try in these new cases is a RFRA argument, Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Yeah.
And it's creative, I'll give him that. I don't know that the courts are going to buy it, because with RFRA, you need to prove that there's an infringement on free exercise. And I don't see how In God We Trust anywhere infringes on anyone's free exercise. I don't see it. But, you know, Mike's a brilliant guy and an excellent lawyer, so I'm really curious to see his briefs on this case, because they'll be interesting reading.
So you've got a book out, Fighting Back the Right, Reclaiming America from the Attack on Reason. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, Fighting Back the Right is a follow-up to Nonbeliever Nation, my first book. Nonbeliever Nation was a book about the secular movement, especially in the last decade or so, talking about historically the secular nature of American government and culture, and the rise of the religious right, and how everything just went so bad over the last few decades, and then the rise of the secular movement, I say, starting in the early years of the Bush II presidency after 9/11.
Yeah.
And it kind of brings people up to speed on what's been happening in the secular movement and how the secular movement really has gained traction in the last few years. Fighting Back the Right is a follow-up to that, really looking at public policy more closely on why progressive secular public policy has struggled so much in this country, and how seculars are an important part of turning things around. One thing I argue both in Nonbeliever Nation and Fighting Back the Right is that the emergence of the secular demographic in American society is a game changer. If we can successfully emerge, you know, so that open seculars are routinely getting elected to office and they're accepted as part of the culture in the same way that other religious minorities are, so that maybe even someday there's a congressional secular caucus in Congress, you know, so that the dozen or several dozen atheists who have been elected to Congress, I'm really dreaming now, can caucus together, just as there's caucuses for other minorities. So I think the emergence of seculars in America can help push back against the just overbearing weight of the religious right and the undue influence that the religious right has on American politics.
So if my listeners would like to follow up with you and find out what you're up to, where would I send them?
Well, I'm available at the American Humanist Association. The AHA's website is AmericanHumanist.org, and my email address can be found very easily if you look for me at that website. I'm legal director of the Abegyani Humanist Legal Center, which is, as we said earlier, is one arm of the AHA. So that's probably the easiest way to find me. My books are available, as they say, wherever books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and everywhere else.
David Niosi is an author and lawyer who has served as president of both the Secular Coalition for America and the American Humanist Association. He's the author of Nonbeliever Nation, The Rise of Secular Americans, and Fighting Back the Right, Reclaiming America from the Attack on Reason. He serves as a legal advisor for the AHA and writes for Psychology Today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for today here on Ask an Atheist. My name is Sam Mulvey. With me was Dave Brulette and Ron John Banerjee. I'd like to thank Becky Friedman for writing, and I'd like to thank David Niosi for being on the show. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv. Leave us a voicemail at 844-753-7842. You can email us at questions@askanatheist.tv. See you guys next week. Hey everybody, this is Sam at the production desk. I'd like to really thank David Niosi for being on today for two segments, for a much longer interview than we normally do. A lot of legal stuff happening these days, and I don't know much about legal stuff, so having an expert opinion really helps. As a result, we were going to do a fourth podcast-only segment this week, but we took a look at it, and it ended up being about 50 minutes. So this week, we're going to release that fourth segment as its own episode. Look for it midweek. And do give us a call, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We were having phone problems in the last month or so with the phone company. That's all settled. We're looking forward to your voicemail. See you guys in a couple days.